First, if we could get approval of the November 20th minutes. Anybody want to move that?
So move, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? That motion prevails. So we're going to flip things around a little different from the agenda. We're going to start with the advisory group, so the item 5 on the agenda. Mr. Shepherd, Mark, you want to? So we're going to do that, then we're going to do the budget rules, and then we'll get to the presentation. Hi, welcome. So, members, this is the kind of result of the work we did over the past couple of parts of the past couple of sessions on recommendations for these executive branch advisory groups. And this, I think, what you have in your package is a summary and a very short but very accurate report on our recommendations, as well as draft legislation and a bill summary. So I thought maybe what we could do is move adoption of the recommendations, and then we can have some discussion around it. And if people want to make changes, we can amend that, and then we can kind of move forward on that. So any representative law firm will move the recommendations. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Mark Shepherd from the House Research Department. Mr. Chair, would you like me to just briefly highlight some of the recommendations?
Yeah,
start with that. Okay, so members, I'm working off of the document that looks like this, that's titled, it's on Legislative Commission on Planning Fiscal Policy letterhead titled Executive Branch Advisory Group Recommendations. I believe it's in your packets. So this report starts by citing the statutory requirements that govern the commission's work, and then it describes the process that the commission went through. You're all familiar with that. And then the recommendations are on page 3, and I'll just highlight them briefly. There's an appendix that will be part of this report that is a table that's also in your packet that lists all 162 groups with their title, the statutory citation, and then the recommendation. And so in the memo document, it recommends that 37 of the groups be repealed. The remaining groups, as required by law, would continue to be reviewed biennially by this group to make sure that they're still needed and to look at any recommendations to improve their efficiency. The commission is recommending that the appropriate House and Senate policy committees this year should review all of the advisory groups within their jurisdiction, and in particular focusing on groups that are going to expire under current law in 2014, because there are several of those that would expire without legislative action. And this commission's recommendations encourage the policy committees to take testimony as they believe it's appropriate from the public and on potential changes in the laws. The recommendation encourages these policy committees to ensure that any newly created groups have an expiration date or justify why the groups should not have an expiration date, that each agency should provide to this commission on an annual basis the name, purpose, and participants on any internal agency task forces. Those are ones that aren't created by the legislature but are created by a commissioner of a state agency that reviews grants or otherwise makes recommendations concerning the allocation of public money, and that appropriate policy committees should look at the process under which those kind of groups operate to ensure that there's public notice and transparency of their operations. In the recommendations, there are several groups that likely expired in 2009, according to a general sunset that was in effect in 2009, and the group is recommending that some of those groups be continued, and that there be a clarification that continuation occurs.
And each of those groups has actually continued to meet. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. Some of the groups that that these recommendations are recommending to continue are ones that have continued to meet where the law wasn't clear if they had expired or not. The recommendations provide that the state government operations committees in the House and Senate should review the 2013 expiration of the Veterans Health Care Advisory Committee. The Department of Veterans Affairs has indicated that this council has been replaced by an internal task force, which is scheduled to begin meeting in January, and the recommendations ask the committees to discuss whether the new task force has adequately assumed the duties of the expired council and provided sufficient public participation. There's some recommendations that relate to specific groups on things that you heard discussion or testimony on earlier, asking the IRRRB for some thoughts that would be reviewed by the policy committees on potential combination of two groups, asking the Public Safety Committee to review the duties formerly performed by the Battered Women and Domestic Abuse Advisory Council and the grant-making process, and asking the Environment Committees whether the Off-Highway Vehicle Safety Council should be extended or whether these duties are better assumed internally by the DNR. There's a recommendation noting that this commission recommends repeal of a Services to Persons with Developmental or Physical Disabilities Task Force in the Department of Human Services, and the department had indicated a desire to continue this group, so these recommendations encourage the appropriate policy committees to take further testimony on that issue. So, Mr. Chair, I'll just briefly then take a couple of minutes to walk through the bill itself that implements the recommendations. The bill before you is in the bill form you're used to. There's a separate attachment that has the text of all the repealers in the bill so that you can refer to that. And then there's a bill summary that starts by listing all the groups that are repealed, proposed for repeal, and then describes the rest of the contents. The bill is organized into articles basically according to subject area. There's a state government article, commerce and economic development, health and human services, public safety, et cetera. And the majority of sections in the bill either repeal advisory groups according to the recommendations of this council or strike references to repealed groups. There are a few sections that do something else, and I'll just highlight those really briefly for your information. In Article 3, Section 1, which is on page 6, at your very first meeting to consider advisory groups, the Office of Higher Education recommended some slight changes in terminology for the Student Advisory Council, and so those changes are included in that section. On Article 4, Section 1, the recommendations of this commission are to combine two groups in MnDOT, the County State Aid Highway Advisory Committee and the Municipal State Aid Advisory Committee. And Article 4, Section 1 has new language that combines those two groups into one new group. Article 7, Section 1, which is on page 14, provides a sunset date of June 30th, 2019 for the Water Supply Systems and Wastewater Treatment Systems Advisory Council. Yep. Article 7, Section 2 provides a June 30th, 2018 sunset date for a Laboratory Assessor Selection Committee that advises the Health Department. In Article 6 and 7, there are sections in each of those articles that clarify, as I mentioned earlier, that certain groups that may have expired in June 30th, 2009, but that have continued meeting, don't expire, and it validates any recommendations and actions they may have taken in the interim period. Finally, Section 8, I'll just point out, is in the draft, it begins on page 18. It's labeled conforming changes. And what this is in Article 1 of the bill, there's a repealer of Minnesota Statutes Section 15.059, Subdivision 5, which is the old June 30th, 2009 sunset date. There are a lot of statutory sections that referred to that, and so Article 8 goes through and just is an effort to try to clean up those cross-references. This document has not yet... I put it together as a draft for your consideration. It'll undoubtedly have some more changes and improvements on a technical level when The Senate Council and the reviser have a chance to look at it, and agency staff. But that's Mr. Chair, that is the summary of the bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first I'd like to thank Mr. Shepherd and Kate. I didn't bring my stack of materials, but I think it's about 8 to 10 inches tall with all the letters and files and responses, and it was quite an endeavor that took a lot of people, a lot of time, a lot of effort. So first, thanks for that, because it's not the most exciting work around here probably, but important that it be done. And I'm just curious if there's been, since the materials have been published, if there's been any opposition or concerns. We've spent a lot of time on it, but
I have not heard anything. I don't think that Kate has either, from people. And each of these, in the plan, I think going forward, is this bill will be put together. I imagine we'll break it out into individual bills that can go to the single committee and then gather enough to be put back together. So there will be another chance for public testimony about each of these specific recommendations. But I haven't heard anything since the last meeting.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to understand maybe a little process here. And referring back to this page 3 of this document that I think we all know about, my view of this bill is that it probably just really covers the first bullet point. And my question, if that's the case, then my question is, with respect to all the rest of the bullet points, how do they get conveyed? How is this committee going to convey those? Would they go out in a memo to the department chair or to the various chairs, or how do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, thank you, Senator. I think that's a good question. And so I do think the bill probably is the first bullet point, and then probably the bottom bullet points, at least some of them, identifying some groups that will come back, like the
okay, yeah.
Yeah, but there's some. But that would be. But what you said would be the plan that this report will be circulated to committee chairs, and then I was also thinking that we would identify for the particular committee chair to pull, like for this. There's a couple bullet points in here about these internal agency task force and the transparency of those that we would.
Sure.
I'd highlight that with Representative Simon, I guess, in the House, and I'm not sure who the comparable person is in the Senate who does data privacy and those kind of things. But that, and I should note that those two bullet points I kind of plugged in there at the last minute because it was part of our smaller group conversation about how we deal with, if agencies take things internally, there's a lot less transparency, and there was some concern about that. And I thought that this was a way to at least kind of raise the issue up and then turn it over to the substantive policy committees to actually dig into it.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, just referencing then the IRRRB, would a note go to that specific agency?
Commissioner Sertich, and I think they actually are interested in doing it's a I think they're interested in doing this, but I would rather they do it than us.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Senator, or Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a really nice summary of a lot of work. And I echo Representative Holmberg's comments on that. But I did note, and I thought it was nice that you brought up other points other than just the list. And I note on page 4 at the top, in related to the duties of the Battered Women and Domestic Abuse Advisory Council, that we say that they should review the grant-making process and consider whether the current process provides sufficient transparency and accountability for public dollars. And I kind of vaguely remember us sort of maybe even lifting up that issue as one that's maybe everybody should look at if there's internal groups that do advise on the distribution of grant dollars or other things. And so I'm wondering whether we might want to add to that point that you had just noted, a point that they should also look at whether or not there are internal advisory groups that do advise on the distribution of state funds and whether they have appropriate processes. I don't know how many of those there are, but I just think it wouldn't hurt for every agency to look at how it's doing that work as well.
I think that's right. So we do have the bullet point, the fifth one, asking the agencies to send to the LCPFP, identify those, and we will then, I suppose, proactively follow up on that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you want more than... So, I think understanding where they all are is...
is a starting point.
I just didn't know what else to do.
Ultimately want to say that there's some guidance on,
okay,
so that they don't, that their work is reviewed, or that the selection of the members, you know, deals with conflict of interest or all those other sorts of things. Sometimes grant making can be as political as anything else that gets done.
Do you want to add anything in here?
Spend much time talking about it, and maybe this is the start to get at least a list of those.
Right. I agree that it's something we need to dive into more. Yeah. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepard, when in particular when we were in the small working group, you had expressed, you know, concern a couple of times regarding 15059. I know that we had talked about it a few times, and in this proposed bill, we are going to repeal Subdivision 5 and Subdivision 5B. And I just want to at least try to understand the effect of repealing those two statutes. Now, we've got 3.885 that this commission is dealing with in reviewing executive branch advisory groups. So my first question, I got two questions, Mr. Chairman. My first question, Mr. Shepard, if we repeal Subdivision 5 and Subdivision 5B, and later there are advisory or groups or task force that are created but don't have an expiration date, are those kinds of groups going to fall into some kind of a black hole that will not automatically come back before this group?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, I think all the advisory groups will always be under the purview of this commission, first of all, starting with your last question, because this commission has an ongoing statutory duty by September 1st of each odd-numbered year to compile a list of all the groups and then to review and make any recommendations it might want to make. So I think regardless of what happens to Section 15.059, this commission will continue to have purview over all those groups, regardless of when they're created. The repeal of Section 15.059 itself, to try to address your first question, in one sense, that section refers to a date in 2009, so it doesn't arguably have much impact anymore. Those groups either are repealed or will be repealed in this bill, but that date doesn't have much effect anymore, and I think that is why, in some sense, it's a technical change to repeal that 2009 reference.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Shepard, and I am aware of the fact that the statute that we're dealing with talks or has a date in it of June 30th, 2009, and obviously that's out of date. And I would, you know, we don't have to do it today, but I would just ask that you think about, instead of just repealing it outright, maybe think in terms of placing a date in there which would contain an expiration date that isn't a specific calendar date, but would kick in maybe 5 years from the date of enactment or 8 years from the date of enactment, or some mechanism by which these task forces would automatically come back before this committee. And because I feel like if we simply repeal this expiration date, that we're going to somehow lose track of task forces. So I would like you to think about that, if you would, Mr. Shepard, and we can talk about that, you know, in a little bit more depth in the future. My second question is this, Mr. Shepard, and I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that there are groups and task forces and et cetera that are, in addition to executive branch groups, I'm thinking maybe judicial branch or maybe legislative branch, 3.885 just addresses executive branch groups, I think. Does Chapter 15 and the repeal that we are anticipating, does Chapter 15 take into consideration task forces and groups other than executive branch groups? And if it does, would we be making a mistake by enacting this repealer?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, two. I'll take your questions in order. The first one about kind of thinking about alternative sunset dates or mechanisms, I think, is an excellent issue for. But it's not really that's not really a technical issue for me to consider. That's a good policy issue for all the House and Senate policy committees to think about. And
but you could help us with language.
I could certainly help, I would work with the reviser and Senate staff on that too. So, but that one is, I feel like it's your decision, and we can help you to implement it. The second question, Section 15.059, the advisory councils is generally does apply to the executive branch. The way those terms are defined in Chapter 15, and I'm just flipping through my statute book here, it generally refers to agencies in the executive branch. So that was set up initially to try to provide some standardization for executive branch groups, and it just wasn't, I don't think, intended to apply to things that the Supreme Court created in the judicial branch or even things that the legislature created in the judicial or the legislative branch. So you'd get into some perhaps definitional issues about like whether this group, which is created by statute in the legislative group, is an advisory group or not. And so we'd have to think about that a little bit more to try to address any concerns that you might have there.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Any other discussion? All right. If not, and so we're not really adopting this language right now anyway. It's more the report and the recommendation. We'll continue to work on the language. But if not, was that Representative Loeffler? Yes, that moved, renews her motion that we adopt the recommendations. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you. And I do want to thank Mr. Shepard and Kate and Representative Holberg and Senator Seidman and Newman, too, for putting in a lot of work on this. So, all right. The House, the Senate, and MMB. On budget rules. Welcome, Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. It's good to see all of you. My name is Eric Nauman. I'm the Senate Fiscal Staff. Mr. Marks and I asked time for some time on your agenda today to walk through the budget rules and answer questions about them. We have a few comments to make on the front end, and then we'll open it up for any thoughts that you have. We're going to be working off of the document that's titled 2014 Budget Rules. It's in your packet. I know there's a lot in your packet, so I just want to make it clear that that's what we're looking for. We're joined by Ryan Baumtrog, the Financial Planning Director at MMB. The budget rules are a document that are jointly created by MMB and House and Senate fiscal staff prior to each regular session, and they articulate the ways that fiscal items are counted or tracked on legislative spreadsheets, as well as executive branch fund balance reports. They also inform and guide the tracking of legislative proposals as fiscal notes on bills are prepared. The budget rules document provides a guide or an attempt at refereeing in a general way common budget tracking issues that crop up during the session. Some of these are quite predictable. Having a set of agreed upon rules allows fiscal staff, both executive branch and legislative branch, to uniformly and impartially track budget decisions without regards to the particular merits of a proposal. And we bring them before you today to give the LCPFP an opportunity to review them, answer any questions that you may have. The last time this group has considered the rules was back in 2002. So it's our hope that you would see fit to endorse them in the form of an approval. I think Mr. Marks will now go through some of the history of the budget rules, which might provide some good context.
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, members, House and Senate fiscal staff and MMB, or Department of Finance at the time, developed kind of the set of guidelines back in the late 1990s that then became the budget rules. The guidelines responded to various issues that would come up as budget bills were being assembled and as House, Senate, and executive branch fiscal staff were talking about how we were counting something or how we were looking at something. And just as an example, I recall the biggest issue in the late 1990s was how we track tails or the costs in the next biennium and what kind of language we needed in bills to specify tails and so on. The rules were refined again in 2002, and at that time, and it was actually a subcommittee of the LCPFP. I believe at that time it was Representatives Bishop and Solberg and Senators Cohen and Denny Fredrickson who worked on that subcommittee. And it was part of a bigger report, but these budget rules were presented to LCPFP at that time and adopted at that time. And as you can see on the budget rules draft, we say adopted by the LCPFP in 2002 and modified since then or updated since then. We update them every year. Most of the times it's just changing the year and the session references, you know, changing fiscal year 2012 and 2013 to 2014 and 2015 and so on. We typically circulate the draft between the three of us and then if we need to have discussions or need to have a meeting or something to work through things, we do that. And then we send out the rules to the fiscal staff and to the throughout MMB. I usually talk with the Ways and Means Chair about what's there so that we kind of have a general understanding of it. They don't get a lot of publicity, but they are there. Some sections have been revised or added since 2002. We're going to highlight the changes that have been made as we review the budget rules. There have been no changes in the past few years other than just updating the calendar year and the fiscal year references. So then to look at the budget rules and just to get started in them, there are three parts, Part A, Part B, Part C. Part A deals with how we track the fiscal years that are the years that we're budgeting for. So in the 2013 or 2014 sessions, it would be fiscal years 2014 and 2015. I don't think there's much controversial in Part A. That's pretty well recognized and pretty much the way we've been doing things for quite a few years. Part B deals with the planning years or the tails years, and that'd be fiscal years 2016 and 17 in the 2013 and 2014 sessions. And the tails tracking is now pretty well established and how we do it, and there's also language in here on how language should be written to deal with what you want the tails to say and so on. As I say, this is pretty well established. There have been a couple changes in here, and Mr. Nauman will talk about a couple changes that have been made since 2002.
So again, since 2002, Part B has had two substantive changes. The first is the addition of paragraph F, which is on under Section 1 on page 2 of your document. The paragraph relates to how the fiscal effect of a proposed constitutional amendment is tracked. The rule doesn't require that does not require the tracking of potential costs associated with the constitutional amendment in a direct spreadsheet form, for the simple reason that we can't assume that the voters will pass a proposed constitutional amendment. Instead, the potential costs should be identified by fiscal staff and tracked separately. The other change that I'd wish to highlight is paragraph H. This was added after the 2009 session and relates to unallotments. That was an important topic at that time. The rule guides the tracking of unallotment decisions by a governor, and it specifies that unallotment is a one-time event that occurs only in the specific biennium where an appropriation has been unallotted. An unallotment does not affect the appropriations into the next biennium. The rule also addresses the tracking of a restored unallotment. So if the legislature will come in on the backside and restore an unallotment, it speaks to that point as well. And I'll turn to Mr. Baumtrag from MMB now to walk us through Part C.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Ryan Baumtrag with Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'm going to walk through Part C of the budget rules, and that's really it encompasses all of the other issues and rules that affect appropriations. These are fairly straightforward, and I'll just walk through them quickly, and then we can open it up for questions at the end. Looking at the document, Rule C1 references Minnesota statute and clarifies that appropriations for state agency operations made in the first year of the biennium, in this case fiscal year 14, are available and carry forward into fiscal year 15 unless law prohibits it. It's important to note that this carry forward from the first year of the biennium to the second year of the biennium doesn't increase the base budget, but just allows the agency some flexibility from one year to the next within the biennium. Rule C2 also references Minnesota statutes and clarifies that agencies may transfer operating funds between programs within an agency to allow for additional flexibility. Language, again, can be included in bills to not allow this. It's not fairly common. And the transfers are reported to both House Ways and Means and Senate Finance Committees when they do occur. Continuing down, Rule C3 clarifies that time within the biennium will not be used as a controlling factor when counting spending. And so if an appropriation is made in fiscal year 14 and it's known that some amount of that appropriation will not be spent, extending the appropriation time into fiscal 15, you don't have to account for that as additional spending in fiscal year 15. Now, if you were to extend it past the end of the biennium, the rules would say that that additional spending going into fiscal year 16 would count as additional spending. And C4 states that our forecast, when we come out with our forecast twice a year, we assume an aggregate level of savings from the cancellations of agency grants and agency operating. In the forecast, that's $20 million a year. Because we count a certain amount of that underspending each year, capturing or redirecting underspending within a current appropriation must be stated in bill language and tracked on a spreadsheet, specifically identified. And Mr. Marks is going to walk through a change that happened to this rule specifically.
Mr. Chair, members, this particular part of the rules was changed in 2006. Prior to that change, the rule required that canceling any portion of an previous appropriation and then respending the canceled amount needed to be counted as new spending. And as Mr. Baumtrog stated, the underlying principle was that we were assuming $20 million of cancellations and that respending some money that was otherwise going to cancel was going to take away from that $20 million of cancellation. The rule was changed largely, well, because both the executive branch and the legislative branch were more or less ignoring the rule when we were in difficult budget times. We were going in and canceling things and counting that as savings. And it's just seemed a good principle that since we couldn't follow the rule, we should change it, and also that both the executive ought to be able to propose and the legislature pass proposals that if you cut an appropriation, even though it was going to otherwise cancel, that you should be able to count that. We also found at the same time that even though we were canceling appropriations and respending them, we were still generally having cancellations in the $20 million or greater per biennium range. So there seemed to be a logic for changing this particular rule. So that change was made in 2006. And as Mr. Baumtrog mentioned, the new rule now specifies that both the appropriation reduction and the new spending must be tracked on the spreadsheets and explicitly stated in the language in the bill.
So, Mr. Chair and members, Rule C5 emphasizes that we appropriate only for 2 years of the biennium and not beyond. That's a pretty straightforward and pretty well-accepted principle. Moving on to C6, there are occasions when proposed legislation has a fiscal effect that begin in the years beyond the tail. So in our current time frame, this would be beyond the planning period, so into fiscal year 18, 19, and beyond. Typically, those years are beyond the period when we're tracking. So Rule C5 provides guidance that in those circumstances, and specifies that revenue and expenditure changes that begin beyond the planning period must be identified and tracked separately. So in other words, we're not adding columns to the spreadsheet to do that, but this rare circumstance is usually addressed with footnotes on spreadsheets, and members may think of occasions when that has occurred.
And then finally, I'll wrap it up with Rule C7, and this was added since 2002 and was to address the issue of dedicated revenue and dedicated spending in the general fund. At one point in time, there was dedicated revenue of up to $25 million and associated dedicated spending of $25 million in the general fund, and that's that type of program financing is more particular and should be done in a fund outside of the general fund, such as the special revenue fund. So at this point, we'd like to open it up for questions. We'd like to first appreciate, or we all appreciate the time to go through the rules. These are something that we look at throughout session, and as proposals are moving through the legislative process, to uniformly and impartially track things amongst the branches. So appreciate the time, and ask for the commission to approve this for the upcoming 2014 legislative session.
Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, question for Mr. Baumtrog, and I hope I've pronounced your name correctly. You had mentioned under C1 and 2 that those rules are being, it's a clarification. And I assume that what you are referring to is a clarification of the statutes itemized in those paragraphs. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. So the statutes there reference where in the statute books that they are and how we account for and treat them.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, if it's a clarification that is needed, and I haven't read the statute, so you know, but if a clarification is needed, is MMB making an interpretation of a statute? Is this something that the legislature should be addressing to make that clarification? If you could just help me understand what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Marks is going to give some historical knowledge on this issue.
Chair and Senator Newman, it's actually more of a reminder that those provisions are in statute. The statute's clear. These were added to the rules more as a reminder to fiscal staff and others that this is what the statute says. And for example, if you were looking at the second one, the statute allows agencies to transfer money between programs. And the reminder is, if you don't want that to happen, if there's an appropriation that you don't want transferred, then put language in a bill to say that this appropriation may not be transferred under Minnesota Statute 16A.285. So when we drafted the rules, 1 and 2 were put in there more as reminders that statutes allow agencies to do these things. If the desire is that agencies not do that with a specific appropriation, then you need language to say that.
Thank you, Mr. Chen.
Any other questions? Someone want to move adoption of the budget rules?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move those.
Representative Carlson moves. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the budget rules, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Legg and Coggins, you want to come on up? Welcome. Whoever wants to proceed can. If you just identify yourselves for our record, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm an associate professor of applied economics at the University of Minnesota and a policy fellow at Growth and Justice.
And I'm Tom Legg, and I'm a senior lecturer at the Carlson School of Business and Finance, University of Minnesota, and a policy fellow at the Growth and Justice.
Mr. Chair, we'd like to thank you for inviting us to spend a little time with you today to talk about income inequality and how it's changing or not and in the state and in the country of the United States. Along with Dane Smith, president of Growth and Justice, a local research and policy organization. We published a paper on this topic in August, and I'd like to invite anybody who's interested to go to the Growth and Justice website to obtain that document. And it's some of the ideas in that document, as well as a few others that we'd like to introduce today. I want to mention at the beginning that our purpose here is to inform you about some of the facts and the data. You will know before we're through how we feel about it, I'm sure. But our goal is to put some of the facts out as we understand them from public sources. 4 points that we would like to emphasize briefly in these opening remarks. One is that inequality in the U.S. is high according to some measures. There are many ways to look at it. It's also high in Minnesota, not as much, but growing. And especially if you drill down and look at local places in the state, we have places where inequality is really quite high, others where it's not. And finally, we will offer some thoughts on causes and how to think about the effects of inequality. I want to begin with this. Economists love to talk about complicated formulas, and in order to quantify the dispersion of income, the distance between the top and the bottom, this picture is a picture of the actual income distribution. It's a data set that reflects the income reported on 1040 tax return forms in 2011. There are about 160 million federal tax reforms forms submitted every year, and this tax-paying unit is anybody who submits a 1040. So it can be a married couple, it can be your teenage daughter, it can be two married persons who file singly. The bins that are represented by the blue vertical bars in this diagram are the number of people reporting earnings, gross income, in a $10,000 range. So we see 18 million people in 2011 reported income between $0 and $10,000. Another 23 reported income between 10 and 20, 19 between 20 and 30, and so on. You see how the tail slides down towards the right. Fewer and fewer people in those higher $10,000 income bins. There's a little blue bar standing off to the right. You see that? That's about 1.6 million people in 2011 who fell off this chart to the right, income above $500,000. That's the 1%. And I find it interesting to wonder how wide this chart would have to be if we wanted to find room on it for every American. It turns out that the top income received by anyone last year, 2012, was $2.2 billion. David Tepper is a hedge fund manager, Appaloosa Investments. Your picture is a little smaller than this one, but I measured my chart. This is 8 1/3 inches wide. I multiplied it by 2 to get to a million, and then by 1,000 to get to a billion, and then by 2.2 again to get to $2.2 billion. And this chart would have to be 1,018 yards wide, just over half a mile, to find room for David Tepper. The median income in this distribution is at $42,000. That's about a little less than 3/4 of an inch on my chart, 3/8 of an inch on yours. In my chart, it would have to be three times as long as the biggest ship on the Great Lakes, the Jugurtha, in order to find room for David Tepper. Here we have another introductory data point getting at the question of how the middle of the American economy is falling behind the economy itself. The blue line here on the top is worker productivity, dollars of output per worker in the American economy. Starting at an index of 100 in 1947, you can see how it's just marching upward relentlessly. Dollars of output per employee. The red curve, the solid one, represents median family income. That's a measure of the middle of the distribution. And you can see that from 1947 for about 25 or 30 years to the mid-70s, it tracked growth in productivity. And then in the mid-70s, something changed, and the two diverge. And as the economy became more and more productive, as workers became more and more productive, their share of that began to shrink relative to the size of the economy. And so this red line is languishing, especially in the last 20 years or so. The dashed red line shows a counterfactual thought experiment. How much would income have gone up if only the worker's share of all output had stayed just what it was in 1973? If that had happened, the median family in America would have twice the income that it currently has today. There are many ways to think about inequality. I want to touch very quickly on three. This is the one that people really have in mind in the current public discourse over inequality. This curve shows the share of all income in America that is received by the richest 1% of people in that year. You can see that in 1928, it reached a spike, a peak of 24%. Of course, if income were equal, the top 1% would get 1%. We'll never see that. This says 24% in 1928. Then the Great Depression happened. The war happened. This statistic plunged. And for the middle part of the last century, for about a generation, it hovered around 10% or a little more. And then something changed in 1980. It began rising. And it's risen, fits and starts, of course, since that time. In 2007, it crept right up next to 24% again. When people talk about inequality, this is what they mean. This is where the action is. It's at the top end. Other measures of this chart shows how the growth in the economy was distributed across the distribution from 1947 again to 1979. And you can see that the bottom fifth, the second fifth, all the way up to the richest fifth, 20%, shared in a very vibrantly growing economy. In fact, the biggest increase was in the lowest quintile. Since 1979, these are numbers out of a Census Bureau publication, the economy has not done as well, let's say. But more strikingly, of the five quintiles, the top quintile has done the best. And if you're in the bottom fifth of the American economy, income distribution, you have seen your income fall. Something changed in 1980. Poverty is not skyrocketing. Poverty, of course, is a serious problem. If you're in poverty, you're probably not flourishing. But we can't say that poverty has shot upward in the last generation or two. In fact, the current rate of poverty is exactly the same as it was in 1993. The top curve here shows numbers of people in poverty. Of course, population is growing. The bottom curve is the rate, 15%. By the way, the Census Bureau's definition of poverty for a family of four, two adults and two children, is $23,364. It does not take account of taxes or government benefits. Finally, the Gini coefficient is one of those esoteric formulas. And if we had a lot of time, we would be happy to explain just what this means and how it's calculated. But let me just say this. If income were equally divided exactly among 310 million people, the Gini coefficient would be zero. If one person had all of the income and everyone else had zero, the Gini coefficient would be one. So a bigger Gini means more inequality. It just doesn't change very fast. It accounts for everyone in the distribution. It's rising, but again, it's not shooting skyward. This is a quick summary of inequality in the United States, and Dr. Legge is going to talk now about some details in Minnesota.
So the chairman and members of the commission, thank you for the opportunity to present this data. Inequality is lower in Minnesota, but catching up, and that's what the next few slides here will try to convey. But then we're going to look down into the county level. That was not in our report, but it's the first initial stuff for our second report, where we're going to look at counties and regions within Minnesota. So the county level stuff was not shown before, but that's where I'm headed here. So this is Minnesota versus the United States. This is the median income, median household income. This is a little different than the family income Jay presented earlier. That was because there was not household data for prior to some year there. So family and households are somewhat similar, but some, so the numbers are not exactly the same here. Households are families have to do with relations being relatives, and households are two college roommates together create a household. They do not create a family. So that's essentially the difference. So if you look, this is one of the striking pieces of information we have. If you look at the median household income in the United States, and this is all in 2012 dollars, you can see that it went up, and it's been declining ever since 2000, not every year, but declining essentially since 2000, and it's down quite a bit right now. It's down to just over 50,000, 51,000, I think, to be more precise. There's a surprising, first of all, you can notice that Minnesota is the red line, and Minnesota has since 1984 to 2012, almost a 30-year period, we've been above the national average. We've done better than the average. But there's a striking rise in the 1990s, and there's a striking decline in the first decade of the 2000s. You see, we're really coming back very strongly in the last 2 years. The data in our report was based upon 2010, not these last 2 years of rise, and we found that Minnesota had the largest decline in median income of any state in the United States for that period. Through 2010, from 2000 to 2010. 2000 was the peak, over $70,000 in 2012 dollars, dropping down to $55,000 roughly. That's adjusting for inflation. It's 2012 dollars. But we're recovering nicely. The U.S. is flat. We would like to be able to explain this very well, but we can't. This has been probably the most intractable question we've dealt with. This is just the Census Bureau data. Here's another take on it. If you look at average household, median is the person in the middle. It's the household in the middle. And I think we reordered these slides a bit here. Sorry. The average or the median household income is the person in the middle. The average just takes the income as put together by the Bureau of Economic Analysis and divides by the number of households as counted by the state demographer. And you see that average household income did not take anywhere near the dip and has been a lot more constant and upward sloping and less volatile than the median household income. Median is very difficult to think about because if I move out of the state and Bill Gates moves in, the median doesn't move a bit. It stays the same. But the average would change quite dramatically. And so we're not really clear on this, but we think there's one possible explanation for the divergence of those two or the differences in those two to have become bigger is increasing inequality. But we're not exactly sure. It's really difficult to think about medians intuitively about how they change and what causes them to change, because you're picking one income, somebody in the middle. And, you know, similarly, if somebody loses a $20 an hour job and they were right below the median before and they'd lose it and get a $5 or $10 an hour job, the median, again, doesn't change at all. So it's really hard to think about that. We wish we had an answer for that. Hopefully we will at some point in the future. You can see the poverty rate. Minnesota versus U.S. We only have data for U.S. from 79 on, but you can see that we've mirrored the U.S., but our poverty rate has been consistently lower. It's been right; it rose through the 2000s. It's now actually declining while the national rate is constant. And here's the Gini coefficient again. This is the U.S. is in blue. The Minnesota is in red. And you can see that, again, Minnesota is has a lower Gini coefficient than the U.S., but it's rising, it's mirroring that rise. So we're becoming more, the whole distribution is becoming more unequal. We're still less unequal than the rest of the country, or the country as a whole. Now, what I'd like to do now is drill down into some of the county data and see, these are preliminary results of our the next step of our work. They are not presented in the report that we had. Here are some maps, and these are maps of Minnesota counties. And the map on the left shows median income, and I think this is 2009. We have not updated this data from an original pass through it, but still the patterns are very similar. The dark blue is highest income counties, and you can see that the highest income counties are those that ring the Twin Cities. And then the next tier kind of goes up towards St. Cloud and down towards Rochester. I don't think there's any real surprise here. The consistency of the ring, though, may be a little bit surprising to some, that's really the truly high-income counties. And then the North Central seems to be the lowest, the area with the lowest income. And this is in 2009. I think the pattern, we would be extremely surprised if the pattern changed by much at all. Now, if you look at the right, this is Gini coefficients by county. And this, the last data we have for this, we've just gotten data recently. This is 1999 data from the 2000 census. We've just gotten data recently, which will allow us to update this information through 2012. But that came out last week, and we're not there yet. But this is the Gini coefficient. Now, in this case, light means a lower Gini coefficient or less inequality. And the dark, then, is the more unequal. And you can see that from this pattern that if you look to the north central, you have the highest inequality, the lowest income. The highest inequality and the lowest income. That's inequality across the spectrum of incomes. And if you look around the Twin Cities, the same ring of suburbs that has the highest incomes also has the lowest inequality. And these numbers are close to those of Canada. The Gini coefficients are close to those of Canada in that ring. And so that's quite a striking difference. So we see that, I mean, the point of this is there are patterns, but it's also that even though Minnesota looks good, there are areas that look really, really, really bad. And here's another story of the, or another way to show the story of the incomes or inequality is lowest where incomes are highest. And if you on the bottom, the x-axis is about median county income. So you see the number one county there is Scott County off to the right. It's fairly equal. Certainly less unequal than the poorer counties which show up on the left. Wadena in this year has the lowest income, and Menominee I think is second lowest, and they are Menominee isn't quite as unequal, but Wadena is one of the most unequal counties. So that's another piece of that story. And finally, I just have this is not a representative sample, but it's just a kind of a selection of various counties. Some of them were chosen because of where you're from, and then to get sort of a representative sample and sort of the top and the bottom. And I'm moving to Aiken County, and so whenever I see data, I like to look at Aiken County because that's what you know grabs my attention. So we did sort of the same thing here, sort of. So Scott County is the top median income, $86,000. Its poverty rate is 5.3% in 2012. And the rank for poverty is, the highest poverty is number one, and the lowest poverty is number 87. So you can see that Scott County is highest income, second lowest poverty rate. Washington County, fairly similar. And Olmsted County, much lower income, relatively lower income, 10th in the state, but still and higher poverty, but not nearly as high as the top. And we can see Hennepin and Ramsey. Ramsey County is very high poverty rates. And Kuching County is another example of fairly low income and relatively high poverty, but not too high. And then Wadena is the lowest income in 2012 and has the highest poverty rate. So that's another... So that's the story about the state and the counties, and I'm going to turn it back to Jay to talk a little bit more about the whys and the sort of interpretation of this data.
Mr. Chair and members, we want to offer a few observations, and here we're going to venture just a little bit into some opinions backed by what we think are the most reliable and compelling data we can find. The first point that we would like to make is that a standard explanation for rising inequality amongst many for some time now has been that globalization and technology change did it. And if that's true, then we are helpless to change things, because forces driving globalization, forces driving technical innovation, are much stronger than any one country. I'm not so sure. We're not pretending that we know how to explain these rising numbers in inequality. However, I'm pretty sure that globalization and technology cannot be the entire answer, because those forces are acting everywhere. And inequality is not rising everywhere the way it is here. Here's one example. These numbers going way back are from something called the World Top Incomes Database. And in our slides, you'll see all of the citations to the data sources at the bottom. Here, the red curve, the squiggle, is the United States' top 1% income share. That's the data we saw earlier. The other three, brown, green, and purple on the screen, are for Japan, France, and Australia. The point I'm making here is that the point we're making, and this chart did appear in our report, is that globalization and technology change are forces acting in Japan, France, and Australia, and yet their richest 1% did not shoot skyward the way ours did. So something different happened in those countries. Britain is more like us. Other countries are more like Australia. These are the four examples in this database that run all the way back to the beginning of the last century. So what might be going on? Again, we don't claim to have an answer. I don't think anyone knows. But these are some suggestive bits of evidence that we want to share, and we'd be happy to discuss them. One is that the ratio of compensation to CEOs in the country to the average worker at their own company stood at around 20 to 1 in 1960 or so. And like the top 1% share, this ratio has been rising inexorably, peaking at 411 around 2000. Then the first part of that decade wasn't so great for the stock market or for CEOs. Currently, we're sitting around 270, the ratio of CEO pay to the average worker pay. And we could talk, if you'd like, about what difference it makes to count options granted or options realized. Not so much of a difference, it turns out. The main story is the rise, the overall rise. Here's another fact that I find striking. The blue line is showing us corporate profit after taxes measured as a share of GDP, of the economy. Running all the way back to 1947 again. These are data available at the St. Louis Fed. And if we focus from 1980 again, that seems to be a break point in our history, you can see what's going on with corporate profits after taxes as a share of the economy. Trending upward, not steadily, of course. We've had a couple blips. But the latest number is the highest ever recorded. And those are numbers that are read on the left scale. So it's just crept over 11% of the economy. That's corporate tax profit after taxes. The red curve, those are numbers read on the right scale. That's the share of all of GDP that goes to compensation to workers. And that's been trending downward. And it's now at the lowest reading ever since these data were recorded. So So if we want to begin thinking about where that money went in the gap between worker productivity and median family income, it went somewhere. That's GDP. It's money. I think this diagram helps us try to think about the answer to that question. This picture shows us where finance fits in. The amount of GDP attributable to finance, insurance, and real estate, and these are four little different pieces of the time series because sources going far back are from different data sets, different agencies, and different records. But just focus on the overall shape of this curve. Once again, it's at the highest level ever recorded. This is the amount of the economy that is received or produced by the finance sector, including insurance and real estate. All-time high. The blue curve here, that squiggle, is the share of income received by the middle of the distribution, the middle three quintiles, from 20 to 80%. And that's been tracking downward. It happens. I'm not going to make more of this than I think is proper. It happens to mirror almost exactly the decline in the share of workers who belong to labor unions. They're both falling. That's what this says. Someone happened to notice that they looked like the same shape in a chart. Finally, this is our last slide here. I just want to point out something about how GDP relates to this top 1% share. The question we're trying to pose with this, not trying to answer, there just aren't enough data to give a really convincing answer to this question, but can we afford to do something about to reduce inequality at the top end? Or is that a dangerous thing to try to do as a policy matter? And what we're willing to at least conjecture from this diagram is that increasing the top 1% share does not appear to have made our economy grow faster. The blue squiggle is GDP growth over time, and look at the last 30 years or so. Very, very variable, but downward trending. The red squiggle, that red line, is this top 1% share. So as the top 1% share has been shooting upward, it has not led to, at least, it has not been associated with overall growth in the economy. We do have one slide that I believe is the last in your packet showing how unemployment has changed, tracked over time, the U.S. and Minnesota alike. Of course, they're quite similar. During the 2000s, that was the one time where the Minnesota unemployment rate almost matched the U.S. rate as a whole. So something happened to Minnesota during the 2000s. We have certainly not reached any conclusive answers about that. We find it a fascinating question. And with that, we will conclude our initial remarks, and we would be happy to take questions. Mr. Speaker, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, for either of you, what would... going back to the Minnesota counties, for example, I'll use Minnesota as an example. If we built in cost of living, it's generally understood that certain counties, and not just the metro area, but Olmsted County, I think, and others that have a higher cost of living than some of the other counties. When we talk about income, and making my question clear to one of you?
Yes.
We do have a diversity of cost of living in Minnesota and around the country, and what would things look like if that were built in?
I suppose it would, Senator Carlson or Representative Carlson. I suspect it would make things look a bit more equal. We have not tried to work with. Okay. With
I wasn't sure, types of Mr. Chairman,
have not
if you
done
so if you have. Yeah.
But I would suspect that it would even things out a bit, but not by that much. I live in the Twin Cities and also have homes in Aiken County, which is certainly not the most expensive. But I find there's a lot of offsetting offsetting. Some things are higher, some things are lower, and I don't think it's that much cheaper to live there. But that's just the anecdotal evidence.
And Mr. Speaker, if I may, and I don't know if you've done any modeling on this, but there is discussion of livable wage, minimum wage increase, and so on, and how that might change some of the modeling relative to the concentrations of poverty, if any work has been done in that regard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, a lot of work has been done in that regard, but it's a tricky thing to understand exactly how a minimum wage would change the income distribution. Here are some things that I've concluded are convincing in the academic record. One is, especially when unemployment is already high, the danger that a higher minimum wage will reduce unemployment a lot is not very high. That is, we could increase the minimum wage a fair bit and not cause very many people to lose their jobs. That finding is not without controversy, but it's the preponderance of evidence from academic studies. The other point I'd like to reflect on is this. If a livable wage were put in place, that would save the government a lot of money. Right? We're socializing the cost of labor in many instances by causing people who work at Walmart to apply for food stamps to feed their family. If Walmart were paying $12 a job, an hour, that would save the government money. Regarding the earlier question, too, if I may, Mr. Chair, we don't have anything about it here, but I just want to mention that the Census Bureau have gone outside of their real authority under the law. They have a statute that tells them how to compute the poverty line, the poverty threshold, and no one likes it. And it doesn't account for cost of living. It doesn't account for taxes or government benefits. So they have permission from the executive, but the Census Bureau have begun producing new poverty measures that account both for cost of living and government taxes and transfers. They change things a lot. So we're beginning to get better evidence. They've got a big data exercise going that will improve matters there, but we don't have county-level numbers. Nobody does to address the question, but it's a terrific question.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know how true it would be today, but when we were going through this, the reason I asked about cost of living was years ago, I lived in a county in southern Minnesota and moved to the Twin Cities. And my rent literally almost to the dollar doubled. And, of course, housing is a major cost. Now, there were other things that I recall living in that smaller community that were more expensive. As a general rule, groceries, I think lack of competition probably to some degree, were more expensive. But housing clearly was, at least back then, a whole lot less. I don't know how that would compare today. But that's why I was asking if cost of living is built in. But thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I found your presentation interesting. Just a couple of comments, maybe question, observation. You have a lot of things you mentioned, and I'm sure you understand as well as anybody that correlation isn't the same as causation. And you do show lots of correlations, but I didn't detect from your presentation that you were suggesting that there was any causal relationship between these things that you're graphing. You know, we could put up a chart of the increase in temperatures and the increase in income and find correlation, but no one would suggest that the one caused the other. That's just an observation. I guess the larger question that I would have, I take it from the presentation and some of the comments that income inequality is a bad thing. That seems to be the point that you're making, that it would be better if there were zero income inequality. If you extend your hypothesis to its ultimate conclusion, if there's inequality and the inequality is bad, then we shouldn't have it and we should maybe have everybody have the same level of income. That would be the ideal state. How we determine that would be maybe a problem. But my question is that let's say that I am one of the people that you mentioned in your graph that was at a median or maybe slightly lower than median income, and you were one of the 1%, and you move out of the state or the country, or you lose all your assets in some catastrophe or other. How does that improve my life to have the inequality reduced by the fact that you're no longer in the 1%, but I stay where I'm at? I don't detect that having that happen improves my life at all. It may, as a matter of a graphic exercise, show some change in numbers, but I don't know that that helps me. I don't know if that helps my life be better, the fact that you have become no longer a part of that 1%. And I think related to that, I think you just made a comment about how if Walmart paid $12 an hour, would save the government a lot of money. Well, that's presuming that Walmart was still profitable. If by doing so they were not profitable at all, they might go out of business altogether, which might cost the government a lot of money because people would be unemployed, or it might mean that they would no longer be in a position to pay income taxes. So I guess my question is, more generally, what is the point of this? Is it to suggest that we should be putting in place policies that would confiscate money from the people who have it and do something with it so that this gap changes? And if so, why is that a good thing on its face?
To either of the witnesses.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn. I think maybe it would not quite be accurate to say that either one of us feels like zero inequality is the ideal. And I'm pretty sure we didn't say that either in our report or in our remarks today. It's perfectly legitimate, I think, to say we've got too much of something without saying that there should be none of it at all. In your thought experiment about the person in the 1% and another person below the median, I guess I would want to be sure whether you meant that that person in the 1% lost everything in a house fire or gave their money away. You see, is money being preserved in your experiment? That's the interesting way I think we ought to think about this. Because we can make policy changes that shift money. Or we can make policy from rich to poor. We do that, certainly, especially at the federal income tax level. And we do some things that go the other direction. But that's a very different matter than making policy changes that destroy money.
Well, and Mr. Chairman,
in your report, I think you did have some further discussion about the fact that the greater the income inequality, it actually at some point, and we may be at that point, becomes a drag on economic growth overall. So, in fact, we are reducing the overall prosperity or wealth the greater the income inequality is in place. And from my perspective, the most important chart, kind of to go at Senator Hahn's question, is one of the very first ones that shows productivity growth versus median income growth. So it's not really the idea of taking money away from the 1%, but historically looking at it, asking the question, does it make sense for workers who are actually producing this wealth, because that's what the measure of productivity is, versus who is capturing that wealth? So it's really not an issue of taking money away from the 1%, particularly in a particular historical circumstance, but how we got to this point and whether that is the kind of society we really want. And I think some of the points you made in your report about the economic drag that income inequality has, not to say, you know, social cohesion and a whole number of other things that go along with the fact that many, many people's incomes, if you look at that chart of median income, their incomes have been flat for decades, whether that makes sense in this country and in this state. Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I guess partly in response, but in response to the question you asked as well, if you have a person in the 1%, then what happens to their money, I think, is your question. And I think it's interesting that you don't really address that in here. It'd be interesting to have a chart to show, corresponding to this income chart, who pays taxes and where the tax money comes from. I think if you had a chart there, it would probably look exactly the opposite. that the great proportion of the revenues government collects would come from this top end, with very little, if any, sometimes they would be reversed at the lower end. So you talk about where the money goes, and to suggest that it would be good to eliminate or somehow minimize the top end would be an advantage to the government. I'm not so sure that that makes sense. If you say, well, let's, you know, as a thought experiment, let's say we passed a policy in the state of Minnesota that said nobody could make more than $500,000 a year, just as a, you know, I'm not suggesting we do that, but if we did that, it would certainly reduce the inequality gap, but all the people making over $500,000 a year would move out of state. Now, what would happen to the revenues to the state if we did that? I don't think that would be a positive thing for the state of Minnesota to have that kind of policy on any level. And so I guess, again, my larger question is, it's great observation to point out that there's inequalities, and you said that your point is not that they should be the same, but it's clearly the point that there's bad things about inequality, and yet I'm not so sure, not persuaded by your data, that that is a bad thing. And I guess if the point is to say this is bad and that we should do something about it, I'm a little concerned about that, and I'd like to know what recommendations you would have for us of how to do something about it.
Well, and we'll let the witness know. It is interesting to me, though, that your focus entirely is on, as a Republican, on what it means to the government, when I think the real question is what it means for society. Representative Davis had a question, though.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. And to the witnesses, I guess I don't really understand what the point of this study is. I don't understand what we're trying to accomplish, where we're trying to go. Now, you just mentioned that you're not trying to take money from the top 1%. So that begs the question, number one is, what are you saying? And number two, if these levels, you make it sound like because the levels are spreading out there, it's bad, where should the levels be at, in your opinion?
Either of the witnesses.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm sorry, I can't see your name.
Representative Davids.
Thank you. May I return for a moment to the previous question?
Yes.
Is that allowed? The chart that I'm showing up here now is the incidence across the income spectrum of all Minnesota state and local taxes. So the claim that the top people in Minnesota are paying most of the tax burden is just not true. If you're in the top 1% of the Minnesota income distribution, you're paying a much lower effective tax rate to all state and local tax bodies than people in the bottom fifth.
Mr. Chairman, with all respect, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's not the answer to the question. You're talking about rates. I'm talking about dollars. This does not show where the bulk of the dollars comes from.
40% comes to the top 2%.
Mr. Speaker, Senator Henn, that's true. I wanted to leave this, though, with you as well, that the rates are not progressive at the state level.
That's true.
If I may, on the question here, or Tom, do you want to?
That's okay. Go ahead.
Well, what are we trying to say in the study? If I said that I didn't think it would be proper to transfer money from the top end of the distribution somewhere down further down it, then I misspoke. I think policies to do that are certainly a reasonable and sensible way to try to achieve some change. Another point I would make is that while evidence regarding the causality between inequality and economic performance overall, I think I tried very hard not to use causes as a verb, is very, very tough to tease out. Just in the last week or two, there's been a flurry of blog argument over this question, and Paul Krugman had one opinion, and some people shredded him, and others shredded them. You maybe were paying attention to that, too. The data just don't allow a decisive answer to the question, period. We get one number every year for inequality. We get one number every year for GDP, and you get 100 of them in a century. It's just not enough to do really solid statistics. That's the problem. So I don't think we make suggestions in our report. I believe they're probably true. We tried to be cautious on how strongly we stated them because the evidence is suggestive, not decisive, looking across countries and over time, that higher inequality in developed countries tends to lead to lower
or slower economic growth, but it's not decisive. Still, that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. And things that we can do will sometimes at least involve higher top tax rates, more generous benefits for certain types of activities, for certain categories of people. So the real purpose of our report, I think, number one, was to make these ideas and the evidence more prominent so more people understand what the facts look like. That's a big part of what we're up to here.
And Mr. Speaker, what would have happened in the tax incidence study had they used the federal income taxes? How would that have changed your numbers? You basically said our tax system is regressive, but we don't use the federal income tax numbers in that.
Either of you, if you know.
And then to my question of what's the point of all this? I mean, what are you trying to say? I mean, do we need to take more from the rich and give to the poor? Do we need to?
Here's what the point is, Representative Davids, and I don't know why you and Senator Hahn seem to be so focused on taxes, because no one's saying this is about raising taxes or lowering taxes. And in fact, I don't think that's actually a very particularly effective way to address issues of income inequality. What we need to do, though, is look at policies that we adopt that actually can move us in the direction of lowering inequality. I'm stunned that Senator Hahn is on record saying it's okay that the top 1% make this much more, that income inequality is okay. It's a good thing, in fact. That's a stunning statement to me. The fact is we can invest in education, we can invest in transportation and infrastructure that helps our businesses grow and spreads that wealth more broadly. There's lots of things we can do with our resources to make sure that more people have opportunity. So this is not about taxes. This isn't in any particular sense. This is about looking at what's happening in Minnesota right now, and we should be thinking about that. We can make it easier for people to stay in jobs for a longer period of time by offering the benefits that allow them to do that. So there's a whole variety of things we can do that have nothing at all to do with taxes. Well, and that's what and that's part of the point. They're just laying out the facts about what's going on in Minnesota. And if you think it's okay that the productivity has grown at this kind of a rate, and the amount of money that
I thought was okay.
Well, you said you don't see the point of this.
I thought was okay. Well, I don't see the point of this. And if you were listening, the gentleman there said it was about possibly raising income tax on the wealthy. If you were listening, he said that. He brought that up.
You guys brought that up. He answered your question.
And what's your idea then? You said spread the wealth. How do you want to do that?
I told you. I think we need to invest in things that create opportunity for people, like investing in education. That's how you're going to actually create the wealth. It's by investing in infrastructure. It's by making sure that our business can thrive. I think there's a lot of things that we could actually agree upon around this table to make that happen if we could break out of this discussion that it's all about either taxes or not about taxes. Well, because there's a lot of things that we can do as a state, both in the government and in the private sector, to make that happen.
Well, Mr. Speaker, it's not about taxes. Where are you going to get the money?
Well, we have to raise the money. We should do it in an equitable way, but that's not the whole. But that's not the whole discussion, and that's not the point of what we're doing here, Representative Davids. I know
Mr. Speaker, that's your obsession, Representative Davids.
I understand
obsession.
That.
Where are you coming from? That's very irresponsible for you to say that. That's very irresponsible of you.
Okay.
I was asking some very simple questions. I simply don't get why we're here talking about this right now.
And that's more a question for me than for them, and I'm giving you an answer.
I didn't ask you. So could you please answer the question as far as what is the right level? Where should we be at? Where do you want to end up?
Take that. I think both Jay and I believe that there should be some inequality. That's not what we never suggested, that there should be no inequality. The question was, our first question was to understand how Minnesota compares to the rest of the country. Are we as unequal as the rest of the country? Less so. What about the pockets? Aiken County is very similar to Mississippi in terms of income and in terms of income distribution. That to me is a piece of information that's useful. I may be troubled by it, you may not, but I think it's an interesting piece of information. Now, I think both of us would say that there's a level at which inequality becomes problematic in a society for fairness concerns, for all kinds of other concerns. But there is growing evidence that, or not, there is some evidence, and people are looking into the issue of whether very high inequality has an impact on growth. And we cite a study in our report that counties, this fellow looked back at counties that were very unequal 20 years prior and compared them to less unequal counties, and he found that the more unequal counties grew more slowly over 20 years than the less unequal counties. And if you looked at the end, and the less unequal counties experienced historically higher growth rates than the others. And the story is this, that if you have very high inequality and you give a dollar to somebody, if I'm Bill Gates and you give me an extra $40 a week, I won't spend much of it, right? My propensity to consume is much less than if you give somebody else that makes $20 an hour an extra buck an hour and $40 a week. And so there's a little bit, if you have a very unequal distribution, it has a downward pressure on growth. And I think that's absolutely true, right? If people spend more of what they get, then there will be more growth, there will be more demand. The question that's unresolved is how prominent that is, right? It's a measurement, it's an empirical question as to how big a factor that is. It's much like, I would equate it, it's much like the question of does unemployment cause people to be work less. Well, I don't think there's any question that it does, but the question is how much, right? If somebody says I'll start my job on Monday instead of Friday because they're getting unemployment, when they get a new one, that's one thing. If they just say, to heck with it, I'm going to just lay around till my unemployment runs out, then it's a much different matter. And so I would argue that magnitude is what we don't understand.
President Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker, for allowing me to express my obsessions. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Lachesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here and for the information. And, you know, I personally do find it helpful and informative, and I certainly understand what Senator Hahn and Representative Davids are saying. It is absolutely correct that the wealthiest Minnesotans and the wealthiest Americans pay the most in taxes and actual dollars. There's no doubt about that. But you're right in stating that as a percentage, it is not the case. And I think, you know, a simple exercise helps Minnesotans understand why it's the effective rate, the marginal rate, that matters, not what you're actually paying in dollars. And that would be, you know, you just ask yourself, do you want to earn $3 million a year and pay literally hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxes on that, or would you like to earn $30,000 a year? And everybody knows the answer. And that person who earns $30,000 a year actually pays higher effective tax rates than the person who earns $3 million a year. So we all know that while wealthy people pay a lot more in actual dollars, it's still the best deal going. So I think we're just talking about different things here. And you know, I don't know either one of you, but I can personally say that, you know, I like capitalism, and I like to see that people can earn a lot of money if they can come up with innovation or something people want and that they're willing to pay for. And we all are served through capitalism because we all get better products at lower prices. And I think, you know, our economy in America is largely founded and successful because of that. Yet I share some of the concerns here that, you know, some of the people in the room maybe do and don't, you know, and that's the question on these charts is when is that income inequality a problem? So I'm okay with some of it because we're benefiting as a society from some of it. But, you know, all we have to do is look at around the world right now and in my lifetime how many cultures have had huge problems when we hit high income inequality. Streets burn, cities burn. People live by throwing rocks. Governments fall. You know, so that's not a good strategy to have strong income inequality. And so, you know, I look at that. This is an outsider. I'm not an economist like the two of you, the professors here. And I don't know when it's unacceptable. You know, it feels that it's not going well, you know, over my lifetime. Your charts demonstrate that the income inequality in this nation is growing. And I, you know, I always wonder, is it the mostly federal policies around capital gains, stock options, as you mentioned? You know, there are so many factors, it's very difficult to know. So, you know, I sit here now, and we're just state legislators, and I always feel that we overestimate how big of players states are in whether it's spending or taxes, either one. You know, states don't have a lot of ability to really make fundamental change on these kind of metrics. And Representative Davis is right. You know, the income tax federally, as you stated, is very progressive. In Minnesota, our overall tax system is not progressive. People think it is, but it isn't. You know, what can states do? So let's say, you know, let's say Representative Davis and I could agree that we wanted to do something. Just go with me here. but let's say we wanted to nudge that graph a little bit for Minnesota. What could states do? I mean, I'm with the speaker here. It seems like it's really not in the area of tax policy. Is it trying to pull people up? I mean, nationally, we've had a few presidents over the last 100 years who have had great wars on poverty and move the dial a little bit. Your charts show it. But are there things states can do? Is it to get, you know, programming to those at the bottom to lift them out of poverty? Because, you know, one of the things that I've noticed in my lifetime in my very own community, and I think Senator Hand grew up in Bloomington, I've been told that, and went to the same high school I did. And, you know, I'll just take my city. The achievement gap is growing. There are more people in poverty in my community than there used to be. What can a state do to address this income inequality issue, if it agreed it wanted to? What are your recommendations for states, not for the nation, for states?
To either of you.
I guess this is really beyond what I've thought tremendously about, but I've always thought that education and infrastructure were very important things. I've asked myself, why is Mississippi so poor? And why has it stayed that way for so long? It's difficult for me to imagine that they have similar educational systems, similar infrastructure to Massachusetts, for example. And that's not an immediate fix, but it strikes me that in the long run, our investment, those places that have done well have been willing to invest in education and infrastructure so that businesses can operate. And it's not that I don't have views on other things, but I think that's one of the stronger, more strongly held views. It's not short. That's not a short fix. That's a long fix, but I think that's the that would be my focus.
Mr. Chair, I like to think about the question this way. What allows people to flourish? You see, the reason I got into economics is not because I like money. That's not what economics is about people. How can people flourish? And education, I think, is probably way up there on the list. But how many moms are there who can't afford daycare? So they can't go to work. Or you got to choose between feeding your kids or putting gas in the car. We could subsidize families with young children more than we do if there's a need. We could provide more security regarding health care so that people aren't afraid to make one mistake. The car breaks down, they can't get to work on time, and suddenly you lose your job, you lose your health care too, that sort of thing. Health care regime is changing in the country, and I'm optimistic that things will get better. We'll see. We could push up the minimum wage so that McDonald's doesn't have to remind its workers in their website about how to do financial planning to get another job. Step one, besides working for us. I think the minimum wage rising above where it is now and being indexed to inflation could do a lot to improve people's opportunity to flourish. These are some steps.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Kiss. I think this has absolutely huge implications for our planning and fiscal policy. And what really struck me was that basically in the decade from 2000 to 2010, not only do we have the largest decrease in median income in the U.S., but it was a drop of about $15,000 a year in constant buying power. That's a huge amount for any household to absorb. We also happen to have about a 6% increase in poverty, but you can't do a whole lot if you're at that poverty level to influence your world. But if you're up higher, you can. And most people have four and a half decades of earning power. And what happens and when it happens in their life dramatically impacts our budgets. Because if You're a young family with children. If you went through that decade losing buying power dramatically every year, you're not saving for your kids' college education. That has implications for what the demand is for our future higher education budgets and our need for scholarships and loans. If you're the family or the household that happens to be 45 and you finally got your kids mostly graduated and but you're looking ahead to retirement, your ability to save anything for your retirement probably really went way down, if not was obliterated. And yet, you know, we wrestle all the time with our health and human services budget growing so quickly because of the increased dependency of seniors. And just given the demographics of the baby boomer, we will within 10 years be hitting a point, not right away. They're going to be able, active seniors for a while, but at some point, age catches up with you. And if they have not, in their prime earning years, been able to sock money away, that has dramatic implications for our ability as a state to invest in early childhood, in transportation, in anything else. And so to me, I would really love to have you follow up with whatever data you could put together on what happened to that, you know, middle median household and the cohort around it, you know, that middle 60%. Did they go into debt? If they went into debt to weather that decade of despair, they're going to be climbing out for the next decade, and they won't be saving for those things either. If they, you know, I mean, you can only cut back so far. I assume some of them did. Maybe some of them sold their house, moved to a smaller house, you know, lowered the mortgage payments, whatever. But I think it has really significant implications for us long term as a state, because we're going to have potentially a lot more people dependent upon us at various stages in their life focus if our Minnesota families during this period, whether, you know, whatever the cause was, went into debt or were not able to prefer, you know, at all prepare for the long-term future without having to look to us in the coming decades. And so do you have, if you have, is that kind of information available, like, you know, debt levels in median households or savings rates or that kind of thing?
Either of the witnesses, if you're aware.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can tell you that we did chat with some former officials in the state government, and we talked to Tom Stinson. He was surprised by this decline in the median income. So a lot of people are surprised. I don't know what kind of data we can get regarding a breakout according to the income distribution in who's in debt and how much and so on, but it's an excellent suggestion. We're always on the lookout for good research questions, and this one is terrific, so thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel, Mr. Chairman, I just feel like the amount of decrease, if our median income has been around 50, I don't know, it bounces around, and depending on what number you're looking at, and people lost $15,000 of purchasing power. I mean, that's a huge dent. And I don't know how you make that up in the next two decades if you're 30 or 35. And so if you could help us with that, that would be helpful, because as we look longer into the future, we hope people will not just be self-sufficient, but they'll actually be able to plan for their future and their family's futures, and maybe that was taken away. And if we continue with this kind of inequity and lack of growth in wages, I don't know how we'll make it up.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, in a very roundabout and very lengthy question, Representative Lencheski asked my question, and so at the very gentle suggestion at the Senate Majority Leader, I will waive my question.
Okay.
Mr. Speaker?
Yeah, well behaved there. Representative Carlson had a question.
Mr. Chairman, mine is more a...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm
just keeping a list.
You know, going back to the question about the value of the report, I mean, we've got a national debate going on about the shrinking middle class. And in my own case, I kind of go back to the World War II era. I was born in 1940. some kind of my benchmark growing up is what took place after World War II and how we had a growing and expanding middle class, things like the GI Bill, playing off of what the speaker indicated earlier, educational opportunities. One of my favorite professors when I was in college used to talk about what the GI Bill meant for him. And he had his PhD, and he was, by the way, a teacher in economics. But it was that World War II experience and what we did after the war that really, I think, was a major kickoff to developing a large middle class. And I can remember, I come from a family, we love to talk politics over the kitchen table. And, you know, my father would always point out that you needed a large and prosperous middle class for stability purposes, to protect democracy, and he would often point to the third world countries, you know, where you had a very tiny percentage of the people that controlled the wealth. In those third world countries, it was often in those days more the big landowners and so on. But you had huge numbers of people in poverty. And the other thing that you would look to and the thing that he valued with his five children was education, that education was what was going to create the opportunity. Well, you look at those third world countries that are many of them, most of them, in fact, still struggling today. If you look at the educational opportunity, it's often lacking, and very lacking, in fact, where the literacy rates and so on are extremely low. So I think the value of the report was reinforcing what a lot of people are saying across this country is, what do we do about growing and expanding our middle class? That's why I asked a couple of the lead questions, what, in your opinion, as economists would, you know, a couple of policy questions. Well, what would happen to the poverty rates if we raised the minimum wage? What would happen if we had a livable wage? The speaker added to that by pointing out that education is so vitally important. And I think Minnesota does have some things to take pride in. And I think most people, when they talk about why Minnesota is doing better than most other states, almost all other states, in fact, it's because of our investments in education. And I think when you look at some of the counties around the state, if you look where educational opportunities are available, where some of our technical college, community colleges, our state universities, and so on are located, they're often in some of the more prosperous communities. Now, there are exceptions to that, depending on how you break it down, county or community, but I think that we all should be alarmed about a shrinking middle class and be asking the question, what can we do to grow that middle class? I think we've had a good debate here. You've kind of heard the conservative viewpoint and the more progressive viewpoint, Republican, Democratic. I don't know if you were surprised by what you heard here today, but I think it's been a good discussion, Mr. Speaker.
Senators, thank you. First and Carl, Senator Centrum.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I'm not sure what I'm going to say, but I'll probably say it anyway. Pontificate, everybody else has. So, and I'll just try to be brief. And I do agree. This is interesting stuff, and I think we could all sit around a bonfire or something some night with a something in our hand and really go into this even more in depth. But I'm sitting here at least a half an hour ago. I was, you know, okay. If all this exists and if it's so bad, then whose fault is it? And, you know, is it a public policy issue? Is it a, if you will, a human spirit issue? And how do we really grow wealth and prosperity in this state and this nation? And a good number of people don't know the answer to that, me included. But, you know, I just think of my own life and life experience where, and we all have these, you know, a lot of the wealth I know that's been created by people has been created out of the human spirit, this entrepreneurial spirit, this thing that government can't do, but good people can do, and do it all over the state, often in magnificent ways, and certainly education's part of it, but beyond that education, to get out and to and to achieve is something else. I'm not sure government can necessarily drive that, but maybe it should a little bit more than we do. This whole thing called personal achievement and destiny and entrepreneurial spirit, whatever we might call it. And that may even create more inequality. I don't know, but to some extent, I'm not sure inequality, as you said, is necessarily bad. But I don't know where that line is either. But, you know, how do we grow and prosper? I think it's by people and many people that we all know and even those that we don't, that wake up every morning, get dressed, go to work, often driving their own entrepreneurial spirit and ideas and making wealth and creating jobs and making us all better and making this place better. So, and I don't know how much is that is the role of government and how much of that is just the role of our society and a society that wants to, if you will, have this bond of achievement and move forward. I just think that's part of this equation as well. The message that we send either out of St. Paul or even in our individual communities about success and about striving, I think it's an important equation in all this. I'll stop.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming and presenting this information. I would want to close a little bit because this was, you know, I did invite these folks to come and talk, and I got a little bit worked up with Representative Davids, and I want to apologize to him for that. But part of my frustration, I guess, is that I do think that this is a serious issue that we need to think about, and I think that there are ways we can work in a bipartisan way to get at this issue, that it's not all about how much we tax people or don't tax people. But there's other things that we can do to actually make what I think is a problem. I just, you know, whether it's fairness or whether it's pure economics, some of the charts in this just tell us that our economy is not working the right way, the way it should. And I hope, and, you know, my goal with this would be for us to start thinking and talking about it, which we at least got that part started. But think about ways that we can, in a bipartisan or nonpartisan way, figure out, okay, how can we address this in ways that allows for what Senator Senjan was talking about to continue, because I think that's right. It is about individual initiative, but to do it in a way that doesn't create the great disparities and really people living very difficult lives and working incredibly hard, two jobs, and still not making a wage they can raise their family on. I don't think anybody, I mean, Representative Dowd at the budget forecast, he made that exact point, that that's a huge problem for us. So I think this is something we ought to, now that we've gotten to a point maybe with our budgeting and et cetera where we don't have to be worrying about solving deficits, hopefully, every couple years, although we can start thinking about some of these issues and working together to solve them. So that really was my point with this, more than trying to make a political point, although I did get to that at some point here. So anyway, I would like to just close with that, and thank you again for coming. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you. You know, my father was...